I don't know how to make a distinction between a Jedi and someone who was trained in the Jedi Temple for their entire childhood and has lightsabers and could use the Force and blah blah. Like, what's the difference?
Space semantics.
Yeah.
I think there's like a space legal team somewhere out there that says no. You haven't been certified in the ways of the Jedi.
Yeah. You're not
Jedi Knight. You cannot legally call yourself a Jedi.
Welcome to Death Watch, a serial podcast about Disney's Star Wars: The Mandalorian. I'm Mike Bennett.
And I'm Chris Skull.
Today, we'll be talking about Season 2, Episode 5, entitled Chapter 13, The Jedi. This episode was written and directed by our boy Dave Filoni, and that's how we know it's going to be good.
I mean, at this point, we typically talk about the director for each episode, but you know, Dave Filoni clearly has transcended that title in this episode.
It's too lowly.
Yeah,
too lowly.
No, he's like the newly appointed nerd king of our generation. And
yeah, we need to get the Film Actors Guild to add the title of King to
Nerd.
The production. Yeah.
In this episode, I found so many callbacks to movies and genres, many that have inspired Dave Filoni in his career. They range from Akira Kurosawa's samurai films from the 50s to Terminator. And there's even his own work in Avatar: The Last Airbender. So we're going to point out those references as we go along.
Yeah. So quick recap on how we got here. Mando found Bo-Katan two episodes ago, who told him where he can find a Jedi on this planet. Intervenly, he went to Navarro to get some repairs to the Razor Crest, and we got some information about Moff Gideon and potentially cloning and other just undefined mysteries. And now we are on our way to reunite the child with his race of space wizards and their laser swords. So let's dive right into the episode. So this cold open here is like, it's a dark, cloudy night in this like forest of trees that have been like either burned or they have died or partially cut down. And, you know, we've been sort of anticipating the arrival of Ahsoka Tano in this series for a long time. But a lot of these, it's like a late episode reveal, but she comes on screen 45 seconds into the episode with her lightsabers out and like so quickly that we can't even like process it. It's just like, boom, here she is. And like, she's just going to work. So we see her iconic white lightsabers that she had in the Rebels series. These, you know, they're very different from her Clone Wars lightsabers, which are varying a blue and green, but they, you know, and it's cool because she's just like, so she's taking out these soldiers who are speaking in an alien language is what the subtitles say. I've never heard it. Have you ever heard what language
no,
this is?
No, but I kind of have a feeling that, you know how like the Dark Troopers have their own like internal communication system where only they can understand each other. I feel like they're using something similar.
Yeah. So they're kind of, it's very like,
Death Troopers. I'm sorry. Not Dark Troopers.
I got you.
Apparently there's a difference.
Yeah. You just got roasted by half of
boom.
Our fandom.
Boom.
It does feel kind of like a Navy SEAL operation. These guys are like flanking out. They're doing some maneuvers. They're like calling out their line of fire is obstructed. And she, you know, she keeps turning on and off her lightsabers. And it's dark. She turns them on, takes out a guy, turns them back off, jumps to another spot. We get the little flick of the wrist and making the noise of like a rock falling or something like Obi-Wan does in A New Hope. All just really classic Jedi moves. I loved the one shot when she like slices through, she's behind a tree, slices a guy through it. And the tree is still standing for a moment. And she like force chucks the middle part that she like sliced out. And it falls and stays for a moment. And then like the fade out from this intro is into the credits as the tree falls, was pretty cool. But I think it's probably good for us to give a quick introduction to who Ahsoka Tano is. You and I know her to an extreme amount. And honestly, I think she's probably my maybe second character behind Obi-Wan favorite in the whole universe. But Ahsoka Tano is the former Padawan of Anakin Skywalker. And if you haven't seen the Clone Wars, animated series, that information will be shocking to you because you saw him as an angsty teenager and then you saw him in Revenge of the Sith just before, you know, turning to the dark side. But in the Clone Wars intervening years, the Jedi Council assigned Ahsoka Tano to learn from him. And she's a, you know, very spunky but talented Jedi. She's very caring.
Her nickname in the beginning, I think, and I think they stopped this like in season three, Anakin nicknamed her Snips because of her snippy behavior.
Yeah. And, you know, she's clearly paired with him because she kind of has some of the same kinds of like weaknesses in some ways that Anakin had, and the two of them together learned to work through those personality quirks as they both grew in the Force. So she's an apprentice to Anakin. You know, she features heavily in the Clone Wars and Rebels series. Sort of 3/4 of the way through of the Clone Wars series, she's actually framed for murder and other things, and kind of it's a background plot, but she's eventually cast out of the Jedi Order before becoming a full Jedi. She's been a Padawan this whole time. And even though eventually her name's cleared, she's allowed back in, but she decides that, you know, the Jedi abandoned her and she's going to abandon them and move on. So she's never actually become a Jedi, although she's trained as a Jedi for, I don't know, 15 years probably. And she kind of
all her life, actually, for since she was a small child.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying if she's 15, she trained for 15
years. Oh, yeah. True. Yeah. We also have to mention she has an association with Bo-Katan, since Bo-Katan was the one who referred Mando to her. Mm-hmm. In the last season of Clone Wars, you'll see that Ahsoka is found once again by the Mandalorians, because there was a minor arc where they had where they met with each other beforehand, but the Mandalorians are asking Ahsoka Tano to help free Mandalore, and she's enlisted to stop Darth Maul. But the very last few episodes of the latest season of Clone Wars are pretty important, because it also gives us a little bit of a time frame as to what happens when Order 66 is finally called. So we don't want to talk too much into it. We encourage you all to find out, you know, to watch it for yourselves. This is all a really great way of putting all of those different story elements together and tying them all in into like one continuous storyline.
Absolutely. And a lot of the things in this episode seem to be from Dave Filoni's previous Star Wars projects, and they all kind of seem to converge in this episode here. So like Chris said, we'll get to it in a bit as we talk through it. But to finish off this cold open, she takes out the remaining soldiers that are after her. And as she walks up to this like kind of medieval style stone wall, it looks like the town of Rohan from Lord of the Rings, with like the guards up above the gate. I know Chris is loving it.
I'm going to have to take your word for it.
Yeah. You guys will have to know. I sent Chris a copy of the three books of Fellowship, Two Towers, and
Return of the King. I've got it on my nightstand. So, thanks for that.
I've taken away Chris's excuse to not know these references at this point, but he may still decide to do that. But as she's walking up, there's a guy up there who's kind of dressed in like military armor. It looks a lot like some of the things that you could wear in Knights of the Old Republic, the KOTOR video game, that you found various armor you could load up. We learned that this guy's name is Lang. He appears to be like a hired mercenary who's running the operations here. What's interesting is I think Lang means tiger in Chinese.
Wolf,
right.
Yeah.
Duh. Is like Dave Filoni's. I imagine he's just walking around all the time with like that wolf howling at the moon t-shirt. Like that.
I'd be disappointed if he wasn't.
Yeah. He's a big fan of wolf. And we know he put himself in like the wolf pack X-Wing division. It's on his helmet and stuff earlier. So wolves are big part of his life, but here he is. He's up on top of the wall, and this woman steps up and she yells out, you know, "Show yourself, Jedi." It's a kind of like a delayed way she says Jedi. And I think you and I both wanted her to say, "I am no Jedi," which is a callback.
And I'm whatever, you know, you just got to trust the direction, but
yeah,
whatever. I feel like there was a missed opportunity there.
Yeah. And like, you know, I don't know how to make a distinction between a Jedi and someone who was trained in the Jedi temple for their entire childhood and has lightsabers and can use the force and blah, blah. Like what's the difference?
Space semantics.
Yeah.
I think there's like a space legal team somewhere out there that says, no, 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 you haven't been certified in the ways of the Jedi. Yeah. You're not Jedi Knight. You cannot legally call yourself a Jedi.
It's like growing up in the Catholic Church for 15 years. And you know, maybe you haven't been in a while, but like everyone knows you as someone who went to Catholic school and etc. So it's definitely part of her main identity. She walks up closer to the gate, kind of out of the shadows. She yells out, "You know what I want," which again kind of sounds like that line from Moff Gideon, which then got echoed by Bo-Katan in this like the way people are talking to each other and asserting their like needs or desires from other people is, you know, kind of just an interesting, you know, theme that's coming through. And then she says, you'll get nothing from me. She brings up what seems to be a villager, threatens to kill him and several others, and eventually just says, "I don't value any of these people. So the more you try to get to me, the more I'm going to make them suffer." And she kind of leaves an ultimatum threat that just says, like, I'll be back in one day. You have that much time to decide if you're going to give me what I want, and just kind of walks away, and we fade into the opening credits.
I think what she's inferring to is not a physical thing. I think what she's looking for is like a specific piece of knowledge.
Yeah.
Which we won't find out what that is until later on in the episode.
True. But
this is like the first reference of what the knowledge is that Ahsoka wants.
Right.
Like why she's there in the first place.
Yeah. Which, you know, I do wonder if, I mean, the way that Bo-Katan said that she's here, it kind of indicates that she's been on this planet for a while. Either that or like Bo-Katan and Ahsoka talk every day and they're like, "Hey, where are you at? Oh, I'm chilling on
just
Corvus."
Send her text.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I it feels like she's been here for a while too, which I don't totally understand. Doesn't seem like there's a lot to do on this planet except for take out this village. But anyway, we cut to the credits. As we come back, Mando is approaching the planet. You know, there's like seems to be a little bit of tension between him and the child because it's kind of like when you're bringing your dog to the vet and they know something bad is going to happen, or like you're bringing them to someone else. I think that the child must be wise to the fact that Mando has been on this like, you know, trek to deliver him to somebody else. And he's got to be sensing that he'll be abandoned essentially to somebody other than Mando. And they've developed this relationship. But as that's happening, they kind of approach the planet and there's this cool like flyover. The cinematography in this episode was great. The planet looks like it's been, you know, ravaged by industry kind of. It's got this like smoky vibe, a lot like the forests are all destroyed.
It's funny how Bo-Katan mentioned that it was a forest planet, but like when you're seeing it from orbit, it's just all desolate.
Yeah.
Like I can understand, you know, when we saw that initial scene, maybe there was a fire in that forest.
Right.
But what you see from Mando's perspective, the whole, but planet wide,
yeah.
We have to wonder what happened.
Yep. And we learn a little later what may be leading to that, but, Mando lands here. There's a little bit of a like banter here about the shifter knob again. the child wants to play with it, and it becomes clear that this is going to play some kind of role in the episode. Every time it comes up, it's usually like earlier it was like Mando accepting the child as part of his like little crew, and he gives it back to him because he wants to give him something nice. And you know, we'll see what comes of it later. As Mando is coming off the Razor Crest, we get a kind of a ground look at everything. And it looks like these like large dinosaurish creatures.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell if that was just my perspective was off and they were just smaller, like horse-sized animals.
They're pretty big. I think when he comes in on the approach, they're meant to be almost as big as a ship.
Yeah, and they're like, you can kind of hear them like stomping, like a little deep bass echoing. So that was cool to see dinosaurs. These have to be the largest. I'm trying to think what other large animals we've ever seen. Maybe What are the creatures
in the show or in Star Wars in general?
In the Star Wars in general. I know, like, I guess, like, on Naboo, there's been a lot of large creatures that, like, the underwater fish monster things. And then also
there's always a bigger fish.
Yeah, whatever carries the large shield generators that the Naboo have that the Gungans have when they fight the droids. And then I guess the Krayt Dragon is also another one. So maybe
I think the Krayt Dragon has been the biggest thing that we've seen. Yeah. Or one of the biggest things that we've seen thus far.
Yeah. But it's still cool to see other large animals. So Mando is like, there's a signal nearby. I'm going to go check out the town, see if I can find out any information. Walks up to the city gate, the same place where Ahsoka was just a moment before. And I got the vibe of like from Ghostbusters when the two of them they've been taken over by the whatever demon things, and they're like,
I am the keymaster.
I am the gatekeeper.
And Mando's talking to Lang. He's like, they just go back and forth a little bit, ribbing on each other, and he compliments his armor, and eventually he says he's a bounty hunter, he's part of the guild, which is enough to let him into the town. He says he's here, he's been tracking for a while and just wants like a place to lay over. So they open the gate, let him in. The gate is pretty cool, and even like the photography on the gate is great. They linger on the gate closing. It's like one notched key that like slides into the other half of the gate, and the way the light, it like is a perfect, it goes away at the perfect ratio all the way around the opening. It's a well done door. If you can't tell, architect, that's what I was focusing on.
Yeah. But as we've also learned in the Star Wars universe, the locks must suck if all you have to do is just shoot it to get it open and to close.
Yeah. You just need
But the door is solid.
The door is great. Let's see. Oh yeah. So Lang is played by Michael Bynum, I think is how you pronounce it. He has a pretty storied career. I almost feel like he's a little underutilized in this role. But he plays Kyle Reese in Terminator, and you know, overall is a pretty respected sci-fi actor. Are you familiar with him at all beyond his just credits?
Was he in Battlestar Galactica?
No.
I don't remember. No.
I don't think so.
All I do know is that it's kind of key, though. We do have to make the reference, and you'll see it a couple of times. He sort of not reprises his role, but stance and even his iconic shotgun in Terminator, it kind of makes it a reappearance in this episode.
He's also in an old Western, or not an old Western. Mm-hmm. I forget what it's called, but it's a, because he plays that kind of vibe here too later in the episode as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's
So Mando gets led into the city and kind of immediately gravitates towards the town bazaar and is trying to get in touch with someone. He asks a few of them he doesn't even get through his like sentence. He starts to talk to them and they walk away. It like looks very much like the classic people who are oppressed, like don't talk to people who aren't your leaders because we don't want you like exposed to other things. He goes over to this other guy who's like helping some children maybe get ready for school, and he's trying to ask them, and that's where we hear him say like, please don't talk to us or don't talk to them, like alluding to the fact that we'll be in trouble if you talk to us. And like as he's saying that, two battle droids walk up and they're like, you've been invited by the magistrate to come visit her. And it's just like this whole town has like a very rough vibe, wouldn't you say? Like,
yeah, it's desolate. It's roughed up, man.
Yeah. And as they get closer to where they're taking him, there's like the town stocks with like, you know, the people, they're not just held up in the like three-holed wooden board. They're like in a three, I just realized this, they're in three ring, but like shock collars that are electrocuting them as they're, wow, that's beautiful. I really hope that was intentional, that the town stocks were actually three rings.
The cages that the magistrate was referring to in the beginning of the episode, we see what they are now. And I feel like it's much more nefarious.
Yeah.
you know, forcing people to just stand upright, and if they move, they get shot. Like, that's, and then kept there for who knows how long. That's torture.
Yeah. Well, it looks, it's similar in like the way that it's shown to like crucifixion, the way like Romans executed people, and which was not really death by being nailed or anything. It was like death by suffocation over hours and hours of torture. So,
and put in the public square.
Exactly. So it's very, very nefarious, like you said. So he comes to, this, like, he's led into the magistrate's inner circle, and the, like, this beautiful garden water feature, totally different vibe than the town, like very peaceful.
Yeah. It's meant to have a very stark contrast to the village. You know, you have the outer walls, and then you have the inner sanctum. It reminded me, if you've ever been to Epcot, it reminds me of the China Pavilion. Like, as soon as you walk in, there's like these beautiful gardens, there's like this pond nearby, these, and then even like the giant rotunda, the circular building right in the middle.
Yeah.
It's definitely a show of power and wealth.
Yeah.
You know, compared to, you know, who this person is in their position.
There is definitely like a Chinese cultural influence on the way this town is organized and the way that this particular area operates. So, you know, she begins to talk to him. She says she has a job for him, and Mando's immediately like, my price is high. And she's like, I have a Jedi who's pestering me, and you seem perfectly suited for it as a Mandalorian, the ancient enemy of the Jedi. And again, he stresses his high bounty fee, and she brings out this sick, pure Beskar steel spear. And she's like, I'll give this to you if you kill her.
Beskar.
Pure Beskar. Like your armor. Kill the Jedi, and it's yours.
Which is,
it's interesting how she already had knowledge of the Mandalorian. You know, he was a Mandalorian. She knew the animosity that Mandalorians had with Jedi, and she already had a Beskar spear of pure Beskar. So already those things are pretty suspicious.
Yeah,
almost as if Mando walked into a situation where he was, where the other person had a better hand, so to speak.
Yeah, well, so that's interesting because, you know, we know Moff Gideon is somehow connected to the Mandalorians because he was likely involved in some way in the destruction of Mandalore. And that's how he knows Din Djarin's identity and other things. And that's probably how he got the Darksaber. And it sort of seems like this woman, Magistrate Elsbeth, I think is her name, is likely or potentially at least related to the same group that Moff Gideon is with. And maybe she got her spear as part of that whole occupation. You know, it's hard to understand where all of these like pseudo imperial bad guys, how they're all related, if they're in a bunch of their own clusters or if they are all related through some central group that Moff Gideon is in charge of. But yeah, so she has this spear and she offers it to him. So she, Mando accepts the bounty. He's like, tell me where she's at. She gives him some coordinates. And then we cut to the city gates as Mando's about to leave. This whole time, Mando's had the child in his satchel, kind of like behind his cape, but not like hiding him per se, just keeping him to the side. Lang notices him, and he kind of asks him, you know, what's that thing? And he's like, I keep him around for good luck. A funny little line. And then he's like, you're going to need luck where you're headed. So, you know, I wonder how much Lang has been offensive about his work here, or if he's purely just been, you know, manning the walls and the gates and keeping Ahsoka out, or if he's actually been on, you know, hunting expeditions looking for her. Do you have any idea about that?
We've never seen him leave the walls, and they always send out the goons in their stead. But when we see him in the alleys, you know, trying to in the final showdown, he seems tactical. So like he knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
he's definitely seasoned, but he's also not stupid.
Yeah,
you know, just tell them where they are, flush her out. I'll stand watch.
Yeah. So
something I noticed as they were really quick, as they were walking out, you hear the child saying Batu again for some reason. So I'm wondering if he's just I'm hungry, Dad.
Yeah.
Could get some snacks.
It's his go-to word. He says it all the time. Again, the cinematography is great. You know, it's now daytime, but there's still very little sunlight coming through the cloud. The sky is so hazy and it's kind of this yellowish tone, very, very eerie. But Mando treks on. He's walking through this, you know, the trees are half knocked over, cut over, very damaged. It's kind of rocky terrain in this area. And then you saw something that I didn't see. I had to, someone else keyed me into it, but.
Yeah, I actually had to have to credit Christy for this because I had to watch it a couple of times to see it. I didn't see it the first time around. But at the 15-minute mark, when Mando's walking through this, you know, burnt-out forest, and he comments to the child, keep your eyes open, you know, we must be close, there's an owl-like creature on the top left corner. It happens like almost right after the 15-minute mark. You hear a bird screeching, which I would surmise that you hear a similar sound in the beginning scene. When Ahsoka's fighting the fighters, whatever, you hear something similar, like a bird screeching. So in this scene, he's walking in the forest. You hear bird screeching at around 15:30. You see an owl-like creature in the top left corner hanging on a branch.
Yeah,
and it is assumed that it's actually Morai, a Convor, which is an owl-like creature, and. Making a long story short, she's a sort of a spirit animal for Ahsoka. So wherever you see Morai, Ahsoka is not that far off. So from Mando's perspective, from this moment, we know that Ahsoka is going to show up soon.
Yeah. It's, you know, again, this is all like Dave Filoni's Star Wars lore, and the owl is part of it from the Clone Wars and Rebels series. So very cool to see it pop up. And I didn't catch it at first. So, Mando hears like a sound, looks off. He's looking through a scope. He sees another dinosaur animal in the distance. And then, as he's looking, he hears like a twig break and then turns, and like as a sneak attack, she hops out from behind something, is slashing at him with her lightsabers. And we get the first, I guess we've seen it in animated series, but the first live action look at lightsabers not being able to cut through Beskar, because she's slashing at him. He's blocking them with his gauntlets, his forearm armor. And, you know, it's pretty cool because she's just slashing at him. He keeps keeping her off of him. They kind of like lock in for a second. He uses his flamethrower to flip her away and then gets his grappling hook around her. She sees a tree nearby, which makes her jump over it and like string him up for a second. He cuts the wire to drop back down, and they both are like, you know, like guns on each other for a second. And he just yells out really quickly her name, Ahsoka Tano, and Bo-Katan sent me, like, stop trying to attack me. I'm a friend. And he says, I'm here. I have to talk to you. And she stops for a second and she's like, I hope it's about him. And because just before that, Mando had set the child down on the rock, and so she sees him, and clearly, like, she instantly knows who he is, or at least who he must be, which is very cool. They cut here to this cool scene where Mando's kind of pacing back and forth, and the child and Ahsoka are in the center of the screen with like a giant moon behind them, like just really cool. Again, really cool cinematography, and they're not speaking, but they're kind of like gesturing, or you know, what we find out later is that she's communicating to him through the Force. Like, they can sense each other's thoughts, which we've seen that for sure. Mando's interested into what she's saying, or what he's saying to her, and sort of offhand she just says,
Grogu and I can feel each other's thoughts,
and we're like, what? We're like, wait, what did she say?
And did you what?
And he, Mando, says the same thing. He's like, Grogu. He's like, yeah, that's his name. And I was not expecting a name, although
literal name check. No.
Yeah. I feel like we'd had to get it at some point, especially if he was going to get trained, but very interesting to get a name. Mm-hmm. I wonder what your thoughts are on the name in general.
I think it's great that we got a name finally. I think, I know that Jon Favreau sort of hinted at it, you know, years ago when Mandalorian first came out.
Yeah.
The name Grogu, though.
Yeah.
I want to know whose job it was to figure that out. Like, I feel like there was some intern who Dave Filoni tasked with coming up with the name, and he forgot the deadline. And then Filoni walks in on him while he's like in the middle of eating lunch. He's like, "Hey, buddy, so did you figure out the child's name yet?" And the guy's like, "I'm all full of
Grogu." Yeah.
Yeah, that works for me. And then it walks out.
Yeah.
Canon.
Yeah. You know, it's whatever. It's fine. I'm sure Yoda was a super weird name when we first saw it, but, you know, I feel like even
I'm just glad it's not Yodel.
Yeah. that would have been great. I think Grogu is like a little bit hard to say. I don't know. Anyway, it is what it is. Here's his name. We have a name for the child. And, it's funny because I feel like at points in the episode, there's this like low key, "Hey, his name is not Baby Yoda. Stop calling him Baby Yoda. It's Grogu." Because when Mando's like, so I guess at the next scene, she says, I'll test him in the morning to see if he's like ready for training. And as they're connecting, Mando says something like, "All right, hey kid." And he's like, she's like, walks over and he's like, "It's Grogu." it's been funny this last week, the, you know, social media stuff that's been out there, most of them still call him Baby Yoda and some started to call him Grogu, but it's a hard name to break, particularly after it's what we've called him for a year and a half. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm still going to call him Baby Yoda.
Yeah. I did see a TikTok video of their conversation or their thought reading where she says something she makes some kind of gesture and Grogu kind of like looks down or looks away that like perhaps she was updating him that Yoda has died.
Yeah, because they were just talking about, if you look at that scene again when she's explained to Mando, you know, where the child has been, she mentions, I've only seen someone like him once before. She mentions Yoda. And then when you look at the child, she looks at the child and the child kind of looks down in disdain. It seems like we're led to believe he finds out right there that Yoda's dead and he's despondent.
Yeah. He kind of looks away, looks a little sad. And what we learn here is like, that's a key little point that relates to what we learn in this conversation is that he was a Jedi youngling. He was trained in the Jedi temple on Coruscant. He somehow survived the purge when Anakin came Darth Vader came and destroyed the temple. We don't know anything about how he got out or who saved him or what. But he is a partially trained Jedi youngling who had many masters. Obviously at the time he would have been there for 20-ish years if he's been gone for 30 plus now.
We asked an audience kind of thing with our followers on Instagram. What were some of the responses that we got on potentially who took him from Coruscant?
Yeah, I mean, I think one that people are really hopeful happens is Mace Windu, because we know in the movie he gets his hand cut off and then chucked out the window, and we're at the time led to believe that he died. But we've seen Jedis suffer far worse, or I guess Sith, when Darth Maul was chopped in half and fell down a huge pit, and he somehow
literally had several story arcs after that.
Right. So it doesn't seem like impossible to think somehow the like greatest or one of the greatest Jedi at the time survived a cut in a fall and made his way to the Jedi temple and found Grogu and then left with him. That would be interesting. And others included maybe Ezra. Someone mentioned the Ezra Bridger, but I think at the time you wouldn't have even been born. And it could be, you know, Kanan, or I guess his name was different at the time, but
Caleb Doom, because he was also not a youngling, but he was an adolescent.
He was a Padawan
at the time.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I think
Jocasta Nu.
Yeah, Jocasta Nu would have been a good one. She's the...
Because she was the sort of...
librarian.
Not groundskeeper. Yeah. She was sort of... Yeah, she was definitely a keeper of knowledge, and she had a permanent stay on the temple. Yeah. But we do know that she, according to the graphic novels, Darth Vader comes back, finds her again. So at some point she may have gotten a, I mean, if yeah. if it was her. But here's my one theory I have is that we're assuming that if he was taken, he was taken by a Jedi. It just says that he was hidden and taken.
Right.
So it could have been somebody who wasn't necessarily a Jedi. I mean, remember where we found him.
Yeah. It could very well have been, you know, whatever, Anakin and his troopers finding him and keeping him to the side because the Emperor had these plans all along to take someone. And I did see somewhere where Order 66 wasn't necessarily to kill every person related to the Jedi. You know, it was specifically to kill Jedi masters and knights, but to capture younglings and Padawans. So it's, you know, possible that it wasn't.
There was a
kill on site.
Clone Wars arc. Yeah, there was a Clone Wars arc episode with something related to that.
Yeah,
actually.
So the next morning, Ahsoka goes to test him, which kind of seems like when they bring kid Anakin back to the Jedi Temple and they test him to see if he should be trained, that she goes through, like, her first test is like she picks up a stone and kind of uses the Force to carry it to him and asks him to do the same. He's resistant to it. He drops the stone. He's not interested in trying it. Mando kind of like encourages him. She's like, "You can do it, buddy. Like, do it." And she's like, "Why don't you come here and why don't you try it? See, he seems to be connecting with you." That's when we get the reoccurrence of the ball, reappearance of the shifter knob from the Razor Crest. He pulls it out and he's like, "Here, like, this is what you want. This is what you want." Like a little like baby toy thing. Like, "I got it." And at that point, he does lift up his hand and grabs the ball using the Force. And like Mando's pumped. He's like, "Yeah, you did it, buddy. Like, way to go."
So proud. He's such a proud Papa Mando.
Yeah. And so she's like, "Oh," he's like, "Yeah, great. He proved himself. He's all good to go, right?" And she's like, I can't train him," which is like the same kind of mirroring of this whole sequence now is like mirroring that Jedi temple scene with Anakin. She said, "I can't train him. I sense much fear in him." Same thing Yoda says to Anakin. Or maybe Mace Windu says that. Anyway, all of them
I remember right now.
Sense a lot of fear in Anakin. She senses a lot of fear in him too. References the kind of the dark years that he was talking about when they were communicating earlier. And his attachment to Mando, like, it causes a risk the same way that Anakin was attached to his mother and others. And there's this kind of like tragic callback. She says, "I've seen what such feelings can do to a fully trained Jedi Knight," referring obviously to Anakin, her master, like her best friend, mentor, father figure in some ways. And yeah. And she you can feel the like depth of sadness in her voice, in her tone. Really emotional moment.
Yeah, she says to even to the best of us, she regarded Anakin in such a high esteem, and to feel and to see the events of Order 66 happening, you know, right in front of her, and then to eventually find out, you'll see in Rebels, she actually has a standoff with Darth Vader, and then she realizes that Darth Vader was Anakin.
Yeah.
You know, so we know that this takes place after that scene. It's interesting how her, because you had posed the question, if she's been training Jedi over the last 20 years. Mm. I mean, we don't know. Yeah. I do agree, you know, that she's got a knack for it, probably because she's, you know, calling back to her original training, but also she's had time alone to study and meditate and practice on her own. So
yeah.
She's definitely more in tune with the Force than, let's say, Anakin is.
Yeah.
So she kind of, I want to say that she knows what she's talking about.
Well, she says to him that she won't be training him. And then sort of like indicates, "We're just going to separate. We're going to, like, I need to get back to the village. I gave her a 1-day ultimatum. I need to head back and, you know, and lay down the law." And then Mando says, well, I was sent here to kill you by her, and kind of like makes her think for a second. And then he offers to help her get what she wants from the magistrate and kind of take back the town. If he will, I forget how he phrased it, but ensure that the child gets trained. So she agrees and they're kind of walking back. And I guess this is a good point as they're walking back to town and getting ready to take back the city. Let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. We'll be right back.
This episode of Death Watch is also brought to you by Skull Square Design Company. We're also huge fans of The Mandalorian, as well as Star Wars in general. And we wanted to share that love by making gifts for our fellow fans of Mando and the Child. Whether you wanted some flair while enjoying your favorite beverage in Oga's Cantina, or wanted to covertly show your support to the Resistance while exploring Batuu, we've got gifts for everybody. And not just Star Wars fans, but Marvel and Disney fans too. Check us out at skullsquared.com or follow us on social media at skullsquared. That's skull with a C, as in,
see y'all real soon.
And we're back. So as the two of them and the child are walking back to the town, Mando kind of starts to give a rundown of like their military situation. He talks about Lang and how he sizes him up as kind of like a former military commander, mercenary, and talks through like the firepower. They have like an A350 rifles is what they're supplied with. Just kind of laying out, these are pretty well supplied warriors. And then he asks who she is. And Ahsoka tells him that her name is Morgan Elsbeth. Her people were killed during the Clone Wars. And the like kind of that loss in her life fueled an anger that pushed her into the Empire and eventually helped her to build the Imperial Starfleet, which we don't totally understand what that means. But to accomplish those means, she plundered entire worlds to fuel that, you know, that war machine. And that kind of lets us know what has happened to Corvus, is that she's, you know, taken the resources from this planet, plundered it in the efforts of building the Imperial Starfleet. Now, we don't know if this is super recent or has happened over the last, you know, 20 years of the Empire, probably the latter, but I guess it's possible that this could be a connection to the future First Order or something, that these are the beginnings of that war machine, and she's mm-hmm. connected with that, and she's plundering this planet for those means. But she,
yeah, because the planet is it seems like it's most recently plundered.
Yeah.
Like there's still smoke and ash,
right,
and fire. It doesn't seem like, oh, it happened 20 years ago. It does seem pretty, yeah, recent.
And so weren't her people killed by Death Watch, by Mandalorians?
Yes. Yes. We find out the markings on her face are an indicator. Her people were the Ming Po, mm-hmm. Which we see in the episode of Clone Wars, season 4, episode 14, A Friend in Need. Ahsoka is there to help a friend who's in the Separatists escape, but he ends up wanting to be recruited by Death mm-hmm. Watch, if I remember correctly. But anyway, she's there to see what happens firsthand to the Ming Po, which would explain why she has so much knowledge of the Mandalorians, which how she possibly acquired the Beskar spear. So and by the way, that specific episode was also directed by Dave Filoni.
Yeah.
So here's another example of all these different Filoni crafts coming together in one
nice
episode.
Interestingly, also the actors playing Morgan Elsbeth is the daughter of Bruce Lee's like sparring partner, and is Bruce Lee's goddaughter. So she's clearly been in the like martial arts world her whole life as a, you know, a person outside of the show. And that definitely shows later in her combat with Ahsoka, you know, in her use of the spear, which is a fairly traditional, you know, earth martial arts weapon. So to see it used, you know, mm-hmm. it was really interesting. And so like the end of this walk back conversation is them deciding to partner together and they have the like comic line of a Mandalorian and a Jedi. I'll never see it coming.
Like to the beginning of a bad joke, a Mandalorian and Jedi walk into a bar.
We'll have to write that joke. If you have a good ending to that joke, please send it to deathwatchpodcast@gmail.com.
Or send us a message on Deathwatch Podcast on Instagram.
Beautiful. So we get to the town. Ahsoka storms like the front gate, hops up onto the gate, takes out some guards up there. The bell is tolling. There's like this, again, it's like an ancient like Chinese style gong.
Yeah. Gong. Well, not a gong, but it's like a giant bell.
And it's just ringing out that they're being attacked. She takes out a bunch of guys and eventually slices the bell in half, which is pretty cool. Like the lightsabers cut through it, it rolls off and like clangs onto the ground below. And then
something I noticed about this scene is that as soon as that happens, well, there's no dialogue, but then as soon as the bells toll on the ground, there's like silence, except for like the wind blowing for like the next five minutes or so.
And then like as Ahsoka, like she jumps down into the town and the magistrate is there. She's flanked by two of these HK assassin droids. And it's kind of like this old Western showdown, like in Main Street, tumbleweeds blowing by. it was very clearly, I mean, it looks, this is another, you've mentioned before, the Kurosawa influences, the way that this is framed as her on one side, them on the other. And we begin to find out why Ahsoka is trying to get to her. She asks, "Where is your master?" We have no idea what that means. She doesn't get the information. She does this like cool move where she just tosses Mando's pauldron on the ground, like the one that has his clan insignia of the horn on it.
Clan of Two.
Yeah. The Mandalorian. And she's like, you're bounty hunter failed, I think, or something like that. Which is another little like just hiding the fact that she's here with someone else to give Mando a moment to get in position. And then I forget, how does the conflict start? Does Mando come from the side and shoot a couple of them out? Not yet.
No. Basically they start shooting. She jumps on the roof and is like deflecting. And then the magistrate is like, with her two, assassin droids flanking her, she's like, you know, take them, hunt her down, take them with you. And then everybody just goes off into the alleyways and starts, you know, hunting her
down. There's these little vignette shots of either, you know, her drawing a few into an alley and she takes out a couple of soldiers. There's Mando eventually reveals himself, and he kind of gets like paused up with Lang, and there's this like cool moment. Like Mando has basically flanked them all, and so he's standing in front of the gate into the garden where the magistrate has retreated to, and then Lang comes further down the street, and so like Mando's between him and them, and like he kind of is walking up very slowly in like the kind of epic villain monologue and trying to tell him like, you know, I don't have anything against you, Mandalorian, I'm just here for the Jedi, and all very much seems kind of like a ruse to get closer and, you know, get in a position to battle him. And then there's this really cool shot. Ahsoka pops up onto the wall and Mando and her are like kind of like, he's like over, she's like over his shoulder, and then she hops down into the inner sanctum. He's kind of like, oh, so I see you've thrown in with the Jedi. And then we cut into the,
like, yeah, looks like it.
So we cut into the garden where the magistrate is ready for her. She's on that. There's like a water feature and a sort of small little bridge that goes over it, which kind of sets up for an epic little fighting, like sparring area. They kind of stare each other down for a moment. And then as they kind of walk towards each other, Ahsoka strikes first. And we get to see like another example, obviously, of the Beskar working against the lightsaber. And it's just like super cool because it's similar to like the the lightsaber battle with Darth Maul and Ahsoka, and the Siege of Mandalore and the Rebel in the Clone Wars series, where it's obviously a two-bladed lightsaber, which is in form the same thing as this spear. It's a long center-held thing that she's flinging around, and it's just like, this. What did you think of this action? Because I thought it was really great.
Wow, it was. You can definitely tell that the choreography was almost self-done, because the actress, she, this is what she does. And even the way that I noticed that when she held initially the spear, like when she was talking to Mando, her gestures and the way that she holds it as a weapon, is as an extension of the self. There's like almost a sense of honor to it. So everything was very, defined, and what's the word I'm looking for? Specific, I guess. You know, there's very specific moves, but this scene between Ahsoka and the magistrate, although somewhat, you know, short run, is a great example of how sequences can be set out in the Star Wars mm-hmm. universe. And but even how she holds her own against a Jedi with two lightsabers versus her singular weapon, kind of like how you mentioned with, you know, Maul versus yeah. Ahsoka. I think so much so that the magistrate actually knocks one of Ahsoka's sabers into the water.
My son had a great joke. He's been learning what comedy is. He's six, actually, as of last week. Happy birthday, buddy. But he had this great joke. He's like, oh, it's funny because her name is Ahsoka and her lightsaber got knocked in the water, so now it's soaked. You get it? Because it's like Ahsoka. That is a pretty good joke.
Yeah, she got her sabers
yeah, soaked. So she's down to one saber, and I actually wasn't paying attention if it was her short saber or not. I couldn't tell which one she was left with, because it's a very tight shot fight. It's not, you know, mm-hmm. like some of the Duel of the Fates or even some of the Anakin Obi-Wan battles were like large areas, and so you're seeing all of their movements plus the scenery. This was like very close in, mm-hmm. and even the way that these scenes were lit, like it has become dark since they've arrived at the town, and basically Ahsoka's lightsabers are the only light in this area. So, you know, mm-hmm. they're very close to each other in the way they're holding like their hits, and the light from her saber is what's like lighting both of their faces up. It's pretty dramatic lighting too.
That's also a good callback to the old samurai movies or just samurai battles in general. The whole point is to defeat your enemy in as few moves and as quickly as possible. They're not long and drawn out battles. They're just very quick and almost to the point.
Yeah, I took actually when Chris and I were in college at the same time, I took an Aikido class, which is involving some like katana. We just use wooden swords, but involves some of that type of combat. And that was the first time I had learned that sword fighting is never this like epic long thing. It's usually like, how can you miss the first move so that you can hit with the second? It's never like 45 parries in, like slamming your blades against mm-hmm. each other over and over. It's just like block once, kill with the second, or, you know, like it's never the way the lightsabers work here is almost stressful to watch when you in Star Wars in general, when you have lightsaber duels and they're just epically long, how they continue to just hit after one after the other. But the
what was that thing that you had? Was it called a Boken?
Yeah, Boken. That's right.
Boken. Didn't we dock somebody in the head with it?
I feel like all of our crew ended up buying them because they looked cool. I don't remember if we actually did anything with them, but they sold them at the martial arts place across the street. those were good times. 15 years ago.
I missed the shawarma shack.
Oh yeah, man. We'll just get into a whole nostalgic section of this podcast, but Ahsoka finally bests her. She gets like this little interchange where she gets her arms on the backside of her staff and then just rips it off and flings it to the ground. At that second, we cut back to Mando and Lang. We've actually, I think, been cutting back and forth between them a little bit, which has been interesting that we've had a lightsaber battle going on and we haven't been watching it the whole time, because it starts and then it cuts back to Mando and Lang. Lang starts to say, like, my quarrel isn't with you. Aren't these fights silly? You know, these aren't worth dying for. Whoever wins, wins, and we'll just move on.
Yeah, he's really trying to break him down through conversation. Yeah. It's a very Western style
and shootout. The whole time they're talking, you keep hearing like the grunts and yells and the lightsaber slashes happening on the other side of the wall. So like very, yeah, you know, almost like bold to have this really. I mean, people love lightsaber battles. It's one of the coolest things about the whole Star Wars, you know, universe. And to have them happening 30 feet away and not be on screen or the focus of the shot is really interesting. But as the Beskar staff clangs to the ground, Lang comments, well, it looks like you win, because I hear my person's been bested. and he goes to like sort of dramatically, he's like hyperbolically holding his shotgun out, like starts to lay it on the ground, and then quickly reaches for his sidearm. This whole time Mando's kind of been hovering his hand over it, just like an old Western shootout. And as Lang goes for it, Mando pulls it out and just hits him right mid in the torso, knocks him down. Again, I wonder why anyone wears armor in all of Star Wars besides Beskar, because I mean, I get why the stormtroopers don't have anything valuable, because it's sort of just mass production. Let's make some intimidating force, but we don't care about any of their, you know, their livelihood. But their this guy's like a hired gun leader. Like, how does he have something? He got shot one time, and I don't think Mando has any kind of special blaster that is cutting through armor. He just has a pretty typical blaster.
Well, I think it's kind of like Kevlar. You know, if you get shot with Kevlar, depending on the shot, you know, it doesn't kill you, but it can knock you out.
But I mean,
knock you down.
I didn't get the sense that Lang got knocked out.
Got back up.
I got the sense he got killed. So anyway, that happens, and then we cut back into the garden. Ahsoka is holding her saber like right up to the magistrate's neck. She says, "Where's your master?" And I was watching this scene on subtitles for the first time, and so the whole next sentence pops up all at once. And so my eyes read the word Grand Admiral Thrawn before Ahsoka says,
"Where is Grand Admiral Thrawn?"
And I was already freaking out before she got through the line.
What did you think when you saw her say that?
I thought Moff Gideon was her master. Like, that totally tracks. In the previous episode, Moff Gideon was talking about having a tracking beacon on the Razor Crest, and I assume that's because he's trying to find Ahsoka Tano to get in. That totally made sense to me. And so for this to be, this is a deep callback into Rebels, and I just was not thinking of it. What did you think?
Yeah, I was blown away. Although, you know, looking back, there were several clues that sort of noted that. First, the presence of Ahsoka Tano lets us to believe that the events that happened in Clone Wars and in Rebels are rehashing. When she talks about the magistrate, she mentions about the Imperial fleet. Moff Gideon is more of a general, sort of like the equivalent in the army, versus Thrawn was an admiral who mostly focused on the Imperial naval fleet. She also mentioned about information in the very beginning, so it definitely wasn't about something, more about someone, but the fact that she mentioned Thrawn was completely blows us away. But it does sort of check, because the very last, before all this had happened, the very last instance that we see of Ahsoka is at the very last episode of Rebels, which takes place some sort of future date after the fall of the Empire on Lothal, and she's with an older Sabine Wren, and presumably they're about to look for
Ezra. Grand Admiral Thrawn.
And Grand Admiral Thrawn. So as a recap, he was the villain around the second half of the Rebels series. The last time we see Grand Admiral Thrawn is Ezra is aboard his Star Destroyer on his ship, and the space octopus manatee things, the Purrgil, they literally are flying to orbit, wrap their tentacles around Grand Admiral Thrawn, which is a foreshadow of how he would be stopped or destroyed or something. And they literally hyperspace into...
Yeah, we should say Purrgil can travel through hyperspace. That's part of their... So
right.
That's the thing here. Yeah, and then I've concluded Ezra can speak to them. He has like a...
through the Force. I've concluded that the Purrgil travel through hyperspace by farting. Because their food source is apparently some sort of a gas
that they feed on,
and that's what helps them travel into hyperspace. So hyperspace was discovered by Purrgil farting. Anyway, Grand Admiral Thrawn, although we first see him in an animated form in this series, he was actually introduced back in 1991 in Timothy Zahn's book *Heir to the Empire*, and his story is actually very interesting. He starts off as a slave his species are called the Chiss, that although they speak a completely different language to Galactic Basic, they're advanced on their own right. And he grows through the ranks in the Empire, and the Emperor himself takes notice of him. So not only does he make Admiral, but he makes Grand Admiral, which is no small feat for anybody, let alone a species that were slaves. So through several books and graphic novels, his story has been developed in the background. So it was kind of sad to see him just sort of disappear.
Yeah.
But now that his name, now that he's literally been name dropped again. Yeah.
So, I mean,
what does that mean?
There's so much going on in this show. I kind of have to start to believe that they may be setting up spinoff series, because like show, because also having Ahsoka Tano here with Grand Admiral Thrawn potentially also introduces the fact that Ezra Bridger could come back, and also Sabine Wren. We still have all of the like Bo-Katan storyline and Moff Gideon. Like, there's becoming like too many things to keep track of. So I feel like they may be setting up spinoff series that, you know, a future Ahsoka Tano show that captures her search for, Grand Admiral Thrawn and others, so that we don't have to, because it's going to be hard to care about Mando anymore or to the same extent when we also have to care about Ahsoka, who we already care about. We also have to learn Ezra. Like, the cast is getting too big.
Well, the fact that Mandalorian was sort of first of its kind, it's a spinoff show based on the Star Wars universe, but that has been so highly successful, leads me to think that they can do it again. You know, as a live action thing with these characters.
That's true.
And Dave Filoni has also gone on the record saying that there is no confirmation that what we saw at the end of Rebels with Ahsoka being a lot wiser with those iconic white robes and she meets up with Sabine, there's nothing to indicate that Rebels ended and then here we see Ahsoka. Right. Where he hinted that it possibly because... And he specifically says the word possibly because they haven't figured out, figured it out how they wanted
to play it yet.
But he's, exactly. He said that this specific scene of Ahsoka meeting up with the Mandalorian possibly takes place before the scene that we see her in the end of Rebels when she's like the Grey Jedi.
Sure. And which could totally, you know, this could be the sort of beginning of that story arc. But in either case, I think we either are going to get these really quick looks at them and then they're just going to sort of disappear, or I can't imagine that they're going to stay in this show for very long. So I guess we'll see.
No.
So that scene ends, we cut to the next one, which is basically the town celebrating. Kind of feels like at the end of Return of the Jedi, when the Ewoks are celebrating the destroying of the Death Star,
Oh, you mean the teddy bear picnic?
Teddy bear picnic, yep. Our guest host and friend of the show, Max Freitas, loves this part of the series.
Shout out to Max. And
it's like the vibes change. Even the lighting has changed. It feels a little bit brighter. Same way kind of Navarro was when we came back again.
There's even music. I really appreciate the music that they have playing. It sounds like it's a Renaissance fair twist on the Mandalorian theme song that they got going on with like the fifes and the flutes.
Right. The theme is just barely laid in as like a few core notes, but there's this whole other like music playing, which is cool. And then we kind of, we see them, they're clearly naming the one guy who we've seen kind of helping out Mando. They're naming him the new magistrate of the town. He did kind of seem to be invested in the town and the few little scenes and nods we got from him. So that's cool. And then we pull back a little bit through the gate where Mando and Ahsoka are kind of getting ready to part ways. She's holding the staff and she says, "I believe this was your payment." And in a classic line, Mando's like, "Well, I didn't complete the job. You're not dead. They said I would get it if I killed you, and here you are." She's like, "That's true, but this belongs in the hand of a Mandalorian, so we get it." Which I love this part because this, to me, sets up a Darksaber battle between Moff Gideon and Mando, because now he has a weapon. A hand-to-hand combat that he can fight him with without having it to be like some lightsaber he found somewhere, got from Grogu. And there's this cool little like parallel between Pedro Pascal's role in the Game of Thrones, where he was playing Oberyn Martell, who is a skilled staff fighter, spear fighter.
Spearman. Yeah, we got to give a shout out to Lego My Rego for making this sharing that mirror with us. I would just kind of hope, you know, they're both played by the same actor. They both equipped with a staff, with a spear, rather. I'm just hoping that the Mandalorian doesn't encounter any mountainous resistance in the future.
Yeah, that's...
And if you don't get that joke...
I would say that Moff Gideon is about the opposite of, or I'll say Giancarlo Esposito's like stature is like the opposite of who the mountain
of the mountain.
This like 400-pound bodybuilder meathead, but
versus Gus Fring,
a part owner, franchise owner.
I think he'll be fine.
Of chicken fast food.
Los pollos hermanos.
So she hands over the staff. We get that like cool moment, and then they're getting ready to part ways, and Mando's like, "All right, well, I guess I need to go back to the ship and get the kid. He's sleeping." He is clearly like sad about this. When he gets to the ship, he's like, "You know, I gotta leave you here. I gotta leave you with her." And then like Ahsoka shows up and she's like, "I can't train him." And he's like, "But you said you would make sure that he got the training he needed." She's like, "Well, here's what I can do for you. Take him." We get another quest for Mando to go on.
another side quest.
I know you've been doing quest to quest to quest to get here, but...
"Go to the planet Tython. There you will find the ancient ruins of a temple that has a strong connection to the Force. Place Grogu on the Seeing Stone at the top of the mountain."
"Then what?"
"Then Grogu may choose his path.
A Jedi may come looking for him." She basically says, we can leave it to Grogu to choose his fate so that he can sort of choose whether or not to reach out. But she also says, "But there aren't many Jedi left. So, you know, it's also not a guarantee that someone will come looking for him." And so like when she says that line, at this point, I'm kind of like running through my head, who are... the potential remaining
Jedi.
Who's
on the available roster.
Who's out there.
Yeah.
We know Luke is out there. We know technically Leia is out there. She at some point was training as a Jedi, although she never really completes it. We find out in the sequel series. Ezra Bridger, we have to assume, is out there because of Thrawn's reappearance. I think maybe, you know, if Mace Windu saved Grogu from the temple and did survive, I think that he could be out there as well. He'd be pretty old, but he'd actually track pretty well with what Samuel Jackson's current age is to play the role. I don't know who else could be out there.
It could be someone new for all we know. I mean, there were other,
when did Kyle Katarn exist? Was he during the Empire?
Oh, I don't know.
A video game Jedi who came up. That would be interesting. You know, I suppose we assume Luke's probably getting ready to start the temple, but no one could really be trained enough maybe to hear through the Force. I don't know. I assume Ben Solo is alive, but he's probably 2 or 3 years old. I think he was born on the day that the armistice was signed between the Empire and the Rebellion, or the New Republic, I guess. But that I doubt 2 year old Ben Solo is going on a quest to find Grogu.
No, I doubt that. Or no one. And we realize in this episode that the child is, we call him the child, but he's still a 50-year-old Jedi trainee who is carrying on deep conversations and even though he doesn't speak, obviously has a very strong sentient mind.
Yeah.
So another possibility is that this happens and he's like, nah, I want to stay with Mando.
Yeah. Well, we didn't mention that earlier, but Ahsoka tells us that he's hidden his Force abilities over time, kind of similar to how we've heard described, like cutting yourself off from the Force in some ways, to protect himself, to stay hidden, which is kind of what Luke did also to kind of get away. Mm-hmm. But
the other is the relationship. She comments on the relationship that Grogu has with Mandalorian. She specifically says, you're like a father to him.
And he may be best suited to actually train him and like sort of pull him back into the Force, even if he can't teach him as a Jedi, giving him the like comfortable place to be to learn would be interesting.
So Mike, what do you think about this episode? What was one of your favorite parts?
Well, I mean, this is I keep saying this over and over again, but it's kind of like a bomb drop storyline episode with the name drop of Grand Admiral Thrawn. The reappearance of Ahsoka can't be downplayed. You know, we've expected it for so long, but I think they did a great job of bringing her from the animated series into the live action series. And Rosario Dawson did an incredible job playing her and, you know, getting her like her quirkiness, but overall positive attitude, even though you can tell she's lived through a lot of dark times, she still had the positive outlook on life, which was cool. But she's also much wiser than the last time we saw her, which was like 30 years ago.
Oh yeah. But she still retains her very genteel. She had very genteel motions, especially when she was dealing with Grogu, kind of like giving him the little boop on the nose, those little mannerisms I saw. Yeah. I would compare with how Ahsoka was when she was younger. So I feel like they did a great job with the live adaptation. We have to remember that what we've seen her before is a stylized version, which you can get away with a lot when it's animated, that you can't when it's real life. So given the circumstances and given the fact that they've got a Disney budget, I think they were able to do a pretty good job with the live action version. I really appreciated that this was Filoni's most felonious episode, and there are so many it transcends fan service. It really is a lot of homages, like especially Kurosawa references. George Lucas was known for Star Wars being heavily influenced by Westerns, by cowboy films, by samurai films of the past. But some of these references are pretty direct. So like as an example, there's a story with two peasants. They help an old man who's secretly a general and a young woman who's secretly a princess out of a dangerous situation. Does that sound familiar? Well, yeah, because that's essentially the premise of A New Hope. But it's also the premise to 1958's Kurosawa's Hidden Fortress movie. The Mandalorian series as a whole is similar to Lone Wolf and Cub, where there's a masterless samurai known as a Ronin, who's accompanied by a small child. And then this specific episode that we just watched has influences from the movie Yojimbo, where a Ronin stumbles on a desolated town run by warlords who with hired muscle. So it's really good that he's looking, that Filoni's looking into these same references as Lucas and others in the past. But he's also looking at his own work, like in The Last Airbender, because that village that we saw looked very much like one of the small villages from the Earth Kingdom. Everything's very monochromatic, very earthy type colors, but then has a lot of Eastern influences as well. And what I really like this episode is not those specific elements, but as a whole, the hope of the future of Star Wars, because they're going back to their roots. They're going back to looking into world building instead of just, and I'm going to use this term specifically, hyperspace jumping from plot point to plot point and hoping to make merchandise in the process. This is a merger between all those things, Mandalorian, Rebels, and the work of Timothy Zahn, plus influences of samurai and Westerns of old. It gives me hope that there's this new standard for Star Wars stories and potentially for filmmaking in general.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's a great direction for the franchise as a whole.
Thanks to everyone who submitted answers about who saved Grogu from the Jedi Temple. Give shout outs to That Nerdy Running Fit Mom, Tamaji 808, David Esley, Honorary Android, Souffle Girl 18, Peter Pan's Cottage, Brooks Jeff, Papa Marquito, R Aura 82, It's Chow Time, Rhodes Photographs, Lego My Rego, Eprez, Ray the Realtor, and Skull Squared. Thanks.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us.
If you like this episode, please subscribe, share with your friends, or most importantly, write a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps our show move up in the show rankings and exposes us to more potential fans.
Also, please follow us on Instagram at Deathwatch Podcast, on our Twitter at Deathwatchcast. And also, if you have any comments or want to make any suggestions, if we forget anything in this episode, please feel free to email us at deathwatchpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll feature it on future episodes.
Thanks for listening. This is The Way.
This is The Way.